at gotomeeting.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. Well, yesterday, President Trump suggested that an attack on Syria was imminent after a reported chemical weapons attack on civilians in that country earlier this week. Russia then warned that a U.S. attack on Syria could lead to a clash between the U.S. and Russia. Russian military forces are helping Syrian President Assad fight against rebel groups in that country. This morning, President Trump, in a tweet, seemed to walk back the threat of attacking Syria. The president's policy on Syria is, to say the least, confusing. And if he carries out an attack on Syria, it may be illegal, according to our guest today. The Associated Press is reporting this morning that Russia has warned the U.S. and its allies against assuming the role of a global policeman in response to what it describes as fake claims of chemical weapons use in Syria. The foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, said today that Western leaders have no authority to be investigators, prosecutors, and executioners. Syrian opposition activists and medics say a suspected gas attack last week killed more than 40 people in Douma, a town outside the capital that was then controlled by Syrian rebels. The Syrian government has denied the allegations. Zakharova described the allegations as fake, but said the International Chemical Weapons Watchdog should investigate them. She said Russia would ensure the monitor's security. And the foreign ministry spokeswoman called for de-escalating the situation, urging the West to carefully weigh the consequences before taking any action. We're joined now by Francis Boyle, who's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. And he said yesterday that any U.S. attack targeting the Syrian government or its forces would clearly violate both U.S. and international law. And Professor Boyle, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Well, Rob, thank you for having me on, and my best to your listening audience, including those people at U.S. Central Command who I'm sure are very concerned about the situation right now.
Well, I think it's confusing for them and for all of us what the president's policy is, because he seemed to walk it back a bit this morning. But let me ask you, you said...
Well, let me comment on that, Rob. I think that is because Secretary Mattis is stalling. I think correctly so. He has said that the Pentagon has not yet concluded their analysis of exactly what happened at Douma. And so I think it was really, you know, Secretary Mattis, who's now made it clear to the president that at this point in time, he and the Pentagon are not prepared to go forward with a military strike, though Secretary Mattis has said that they are preparing options in the event that the president should make a decision. And indeed, what happened the last time after when Trump made the cruise missile attacks, those were clearly illegal too, and that was a bogus claim of sarin there. Eventually, I believe Secretary Mattis came out and said, well, yeah, we didn't really have any evidence to establish exactly what happened there. But that attack, the last one, was highly impulsive by President Trump. With all due respect there to the president, he was just acting off what he saw on, I guess, the TV screens. Whereas I think that Secretary Mattis and the Pentagon realized that given the current situation, this could erupt. As you correctly pointed out, you have Russian forces all over there. The Russian Defense Ministry spokesperson General Gerasimov, said that in the event any of our military people are killed, we will respond. Now, that did not apply to their mercenaries. As you know, the Air Force over there killed large numbers, apparently bombed large numbers of Russian mercenaries. And Russia did not react to that.
The U.S. Air Force. U.S. Air Force did that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But they did not react to mercenaries, but they've made it clear that, you know, if their forces, their armed forces are hit over there, there will be a response. Now, I don't know. President Putin has just made a statement here calling for calm. And this might be a good sign that, you know, President Trump is backing down, perhaps because of the influence of Secretary Mattis, and he understands the, you know, the military implications of what would happen here. You know, you could have that whole region blow up if in fact we kill Russian troops, Russian military forces. And this also gets back to President Trump's statement that, you know, cruise missiles are coming, that he made on tweet. If you look at what happened the last time, we told the Russians where we were going to hit. And so the Russians pulled all their troops out of there. So we didn't kill any Russian troops. We just hit it in an air base. Unfortunately, we killed some Syrians. So the same scenario is going on here, that right now it's already been reported. You know, there's a military coordination through El Udeid Air Base there in Doha, and then the Russian military at one of their bases in Syria. So they've been told to, you know, get their armed forces out of the way of whatever our targets might be. And so, you know, Trump saying this in a tweet is that's the same message. But it does not appear right now, thank heaven, that, you know, he's going to go ahead with a military strike. And I think it's their Secretary Mattis, he's the only sane voice we have there anymore.
I want to go
John
back.
John Bolton, you know, is just a neocon imperial warmonger. So as of now. I wish I could give you a better analysis, Rob.
Yeah, I want to go back to your comment about sarin gas, because it seems to me that one of the big questions is, was this a gas attack last week? And if so, who conducted the gas attack? You said a moment ago that a year ago when the U.S. attacked the Syrian airbase, that alleged sarin gas attack that preceded that was bogus. Why do you say that?
Right. Well, Rob, let me first say I drafted the U.S. Domestic implementing legislation for the Biological Weapons Convention of 1972, which is known as the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, that was passed unanimously by both houses of the United States Congress and signed into law by President Bush Sr. So I do follow these things. Now, the allegation of sarin was completely bogus. If in fact, this had been, if you looked at the pictures, they were clearly propaganda pictures. If this had been sarin, everyone would have died within a few minutes. And that is not what we were seeing in these pictures. And see, the first responders did not have protective gear or anything like that. Now, later on, Seymour Martin Hirsch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who exposed the My Lai massacre, did a very extensive analysis published in the German news media, completely debunking this allegation. So I agree with that. I also believe that Professor Ted Postel, who teaches at MIT and has expertise in U.S. weapons, he used to work for the Pentagon or something like that, he debunked it too. So it's clear that, and I'm not blaming President Trump here in the sense that I think he acted impulsively in accordance with this propaganda that was being shown on the TV stations. You know, a so-called false flag attack. But this time it's far more serious. And so I think that Secretary of Defense Mattis is slow walking this thing. And it seems to me this is history repeating itself. Indeed, the You hear all this criticism of Obama backing down over Ghouta, and that, too, was completely bogus. I had exposed that while it was going on. It made no sense at all. Likewise, Seymour Martin Hirsch wrote a very extensive expose of that Obama incident. That was in the London Review of Books. And then if you hit the internet, Professor Ted Postol, who, you know, has expertise handling U.S. weapon systems, also did an analysis and said it was completely bogus. So what we see here is a pattern of behavior that, you know, we have to understand it was Obama who put all these terrorist jihadis into Syria after he and Clinton did such a great job destroying Libya. They then decided to repeat it on Syria. So he was the one who put all these terrorist jihadis there into Syria. And as they when Russia and Iran legally intervened at the request of the Syrian government, throwing back these terrorist jihadis that Obama put in there, I call them Obama's terrorist jihadis, whenever they're on the verge of collapsing somewhere, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they produce a chemical weapons attack. And it's clear, you know, these, for the most part, I'm not over there myself, but I do follow these things professionally. There's a consistent pattern here. And the terrorist jihadis were about to be driven out of Douma, and so they staged this latest bogus attack to try to get President Trump to intervene militarily, like he did the last time. But the last time was, you know, more of a pinprick attack, not to diminish the lives that were all lost. That, you know, that's a consistent pattern that's been going on here, Rob. My assessment of the situation.
Well, we're talking with Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. He's the author of many books, a graduate of Harvard University. Well, if it's not sarin gas, it looks like some sort of chemical weapons were used. At least, you know, we see these videos and these shocking, we've seen it several times coming out of Syria. So what's going on? Are you saying these videos are doctored? Or something?
I'm afraid it looks like that.
But something appears to be going on, doesn't it?
Right. It's exactly what happened the last time where they alleged sarin. And everyone, if that had been sarin, everyone would have been dead very quickly. I'm sure you could talk to your military people there, Central Command. They'll tell you you'd be dead from sarin within 2 to 3 minutes at best, no more than five. And what you had the last time was all these so-called first responders picking these people up. They weren't even wearing protective gear. If you were dealing with sarin, you'd have to be wearing, heavy-duty suit, almost like a moon suit, covering with your own oxygen supply. That's how dangerous sarin is. So I don't know what this was, but, it just seems to me it's, as Yogi Berra put it, deja vu all over again now for a third time. And the Syrian Red Cross, these white helmets people, they work with our terrorist jihadis. They've been paid for by British intelligence, the CIA, and USAID, which is sort of an adjunct of the CIA. That's been documented if you want to look at. And they work in cahoots with Obama's terrorist jihadis. So you can't believe anything they're telling you. Now, there is the Syrian Red Crescent said that, you know, they have no evidence of a chemical weapon being used here. We'll just have to see. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons says it's going in there. Russia, the terrorist jihadis, just Obama's terrorist jihadis, just evacuated Douma. Russia was in there. They said they found no evidence. Well, I don't know if that's true or it isn't. But right now, we don't have any evidence. And indeed, under international law, the standard for circumstantial evidence, which is all we have now, is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We have no proof. But we've been through this before at least three times now to provoke U.S. Military intervention. once under Obama in 2013 that failed, second time under Trump, which succeeded, but you know that was more of a pinprick strike. But this time, you know, it looks like it would be very serious, and it seems that Secretary Mattis is slow walking this thing.
All right, there's so much here I want to ask you about. But first of all, to the big picture, whether it was President Obama launching an attack or whether it was President Trump last year or President Trump's threat this week, would that be legal? Would it be legal for the U.S. to attack Syria under international law?
No, of course not.
Why not?
It would violate both the United Nations Charter and also the War Powers Clause of the United States Constitution and the War Powers Resolution if they did not have express authorization from the United States Congress, which they do not do. And indeed, several congressmen, members of Congress, Senate have pointed that out. Even Republicans these days are pointing that out, that Trump and, you know, before him, Obama, had no authorization
well,
from Congress.
Let me read what...
violating the U.N. Charter.
Well,
and,
let me...
By the way, we do know that one of the reasons Obama backed down in 2013 was he feared impeachment. He said, Ben Rhodes said that he feared that without authorization by Congress, he feared impeachment. Now, Obama, you know,
Rhodes was
at Harvard Law School, so he understands.
All right, Rhodes was Obama's deputy national security advisor. Okay, let me just ask you this about this quote, though. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, claimed last year at the National Press Club that the U.S. government has the authority to target the Syrian government. It stems from the 2001 authorization for the use of military force that paved the way for the U.S. to invade Iraq. So that's the justification. So does that authorization for the use of military force extend to Syria?
Well, of course not. He was referring there in that statement, which I have. First of all, he's a general. He's not a lawyer, right? But that statement, he was referring to ISIS. Trying to cobble together a legal pretext to attack ISIS, going back to the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, which, you know, President Bush Jr. did get against Afghanistan. I opposed it. I thought it was a very dangerous, reckless thing to do. But he did get it, but that was 2001. You know, this is now, well, that was the statement there was what, 2018, 2017, and that only dealt with ISIS. It did not deal with the government of Syria. It had nothing to do with chemical weapons.
So if President Trump is...
Even if you read today, in the newspapers and the media, everyone's saying, you know, Trump would be out there on his own with no authorization to do anything on the basis of a 2001 resolution that was intended to deal with the terrible terrorist attacks of 9/11-2001. This has nothing to do with any of it. You know, Dunford is just throwing up smoke there.
So if President Trump were to launch an attack, would that be an impeachable offense in your, according to your analysis?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, back in... 1991, I worked with the late great Congressman Henry B. Gonzalez of Texas and Ramsey Clark on a campaign to impeach Bush Sr. If he went to war against Iraq. And I did the first draft of the impeachment resolution that Congressman Gonzalez introduced into the U.S. House of Representatives. So I have some practical experience here. We did not stop that war, regretfully. You know, it was a terrible war. Maybe 200,000 Iraqis were killed. And now we know that maybe 11,000 or more U.S. forces have died needlessly from the Gulf War syndrome. But that's another issue. But according to Bush's memoirs, Bush Sr.'s memoirs, the reason he did not go all the way to Baghdad was that he feared impeachment. He said that. So I guess Gonzales, Clark, and I did have an impact, and our campaign did have an impact there. Regretfully, that did not deter his son. I had launched a campaign to put in a bill of impeachment to try to stop his son, Bush Jr., from his catastrophic war against Iraq. And that was killed by the Democratic National Committee. They killed that bill of impeachment. John Podesta showed up at the meeting and just said, we're against it, and that was that. So we, you know, Clark and I did try on that one, too.
We're talking with Francis. We're talking with Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. Francis, I know we had talked about talking for 15 minutes, and we're already way past 15 minutes. Do you still have some time?
Sure, Rob. I think this is very important, especially, you know, you have your military personnel over there at
MacDill.
U.S. Central Command trying to figure out what's going on here, because, you know, if Trump attacks, this whole thing blows up.
Well, you know, let me ask you about that. You just mentioned World War III. Why do you think that if this is done poorly, if President Trump handles this poorly, that this could lead to World War III?
Sure. Right now, there's a picket line of Russian naval forces right off the coast of Syria. They have also alerted their entire Black Sea fleet. They're on a war standing. Israel is on a war footing. Iran is on a war footing. Syria is on a war footing. Russia has these S-400 anti-aircraft systems there in Syria that, you know, basically they've established a no-fly zone and are fully prepared to shoot down any jet fighter bombers or anything that go in there. France is talking about doing that. Obviously, they'll try to shoot down cruise missiles. And the Russian government has publicly stated that if any of their military forces are killed, they will respond. Now, Trump has tried to warn them publicly to get your military forces out of the way. Maybe they have, maybe they haven't. I really don't know where the Russian military forces are. And then if we start killing more Iranians over there, they can respond as well. And Israel is always a wild card. They were just attacking Syria. So the whole situation there could blow up if Trump decides to launch a what the reports are now they're preparing is a very significant cruise missile strike, and the British have a submarine over there that could send cruise missiles. The French have a submarine that can send cruise missiles, and apparently the French are preparing jet fighter bombers down there in Jordan. So, you know, we already have, and there's Turkey in there, too, that has illegally invaded Syria. So, you know, if something goes wrong, this whole situation could blow up.
You mentioned
you have all these countries involved. I mean, you know, Rob, go back and read how the First World War started. And it's a very dangerous situation right now.
You mentioned Israel just bombed for a short time Syria. It flew through Lebanon to do that. What's your sense of how that might play into a World War III scenario? Did Israel have justification for bombing Syria and flying through Lebanon to do it?
No, it's a double illegality. Both Lebanon and going into Lebanese airspace and then attacking Syria. The problem here is that Israel could stage some type of military provocation to set this whole thing off under the. Time there with Obama where everyone was on a hair trigger. At that point, Putin had about 10 Russian ships setting up a picket line off the coast of Syria, and there was one Chinese ship. It appears Israel sent at least one cruise missile in there to try to set things off, even though Obama was contemplating what he was going to do. And it does appear that cruise missile was shot down. But there was one cruise missile lobbed in there, and it looks like Israel did it. So they could be a wild card here. Sure, they, you know, they like to take out Syria and Iran together, and they would like us to do their dirty work for them. I mean, they're more than Israel has always been more than happy to have the young men and young women of our armed forces do their dirty work for them, as they did in Iraq 1, Iraq 2. They'd like to do now against Iran. They can't do it on their own, so they'd like to use our military personnel to do this. So they are a wild card. I don't know what they will do.
What's the end game in Syria? I mean, do you see Russia, Iran, the U.S., Israel all looking, vying to take part of Syria's territory and leaving President Assad the mayor of Damascus? I mean, what's your sense of what's the end game?
I think you're right, Rob, that basically what we're seeing now, we have seen is sort of the de facto carve-up of Syria, and that President Assad, as you correctly said, is pretty much the mayor of Damascus. And, you know, this is sort of like the old colonial imperial era, where all the old colonial imperial powers are carving up the region. You have Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. They just took a slice off of Syria. They're in there. We're in there. Now, you know, we weren't the imperial power back in those days. The British were in there. Remember, France is in there. France was the imperial occupier of Syria after the First World War. So, yeah, and then there's oil. You'll note, Rob, that right now, U.S. military forces are occupying the oil fields in Syria with our Kurdish surrogates. We're sitting right on top of their oil. And, of course, Syria is very important for oil pipelines from the Gulf to Europe. And then it could be a jumping-off point for Iran, a final attack on Iran, which Bolton, who is now the new national security advisor to President Trump, has called for. Remember, Bolton signed that PNAC report, Project for a New American Century, by all the neocon warmongers, literally, sort of the neocon Mein Kampf, and they came into power under Bush Jr. and, you know, just attacked Afghanistan, destroyed it, and destroyed Iraq. So, that's where we are. But I think you're right. It's an imperial carve-up of Syria going on right now.
I want to go back.
We're in on it.
I want to go back to a term that you used earlier. You mentioned Obama's terrorist jihadis or our terrorist jihadis being in this town of Ghouta. When you say...
I'm sorry.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Obama... As I said, he was behind me at Harvard Law School, so I followed his career for a long time. And he decided, you know, to stage a pretext to overthrow and destroy the Gaddafi government there in Libya. I won't go through the whole history of that, but they created total catastrophe over there, Obama and Clinton. They murdered about 50,000 Libyans, destroyed that state. And now it's total chaos in Libya. They did that because of the oil over there. So once that succeeded, they moved on to Syria using the exact same, and they were using terrorist jihadis against Gaddafi. They had always been these Islamic fundamentalist terrorists had always been Gaddafi's foremost opponent. So those are the people they were using. And then they moved on to Syria. And indeed, if you read the memoirs of General Wesley Clark, after 9/11 2001, he four-star general commander of NATO, he went to the Pentagon. And the people in the Pentagon told him that there was a plan, a neoconservative plan, to attack about seven Muslim countries in a row. There would be Afghanistan, there would be Iraq, there would be Libya, Syria was on the hit list, Lebanon, Sudan, Iran. And, you know, we have yet to attack Iran. Sudan has, you know, pretty much capitulated to our wishes, so I don't think they're on the list. But Syria was clearly on the list, and you can read that in Clark's memoirs. I have a new book out called Destroying Libyan World Order, and Libya was on the list, and Iraq was on the list, Afghanistan was on the list, Lebanon was on the list, Iran's on the list. So there we are. So this has been planned for quite some time.
Are you saying that the U.S. funded these people, or or was
CIA.
It was the CIA?
Yep.
How do you know that? How do you know that they funded these?
It was the CIA, and we also got the Saudis to fund them, and the Emiratis, and Qatar. Right, that's where all the funding came from. The Pentagon was tasked to arm, equip, supply, and train some of these people, but as far as I could tell, the Pentagon slow walked the whole thing because they were not, they did a few, but they were not really interested in getting involved in this. So it was basically the CIA, and then a lot of the money came from the Saudis, the Emiratis, and Qatar. Right?
Now, are these people the same as ISIS, what we call ISIS over here?
Sure, they're all the same. I mean, you know, they're interchangeable, fungible people one way or the other. I mean, look, Rob, we've been using Islamic fundamentalists going back to the Carter administration and Zbigniew Brzezinski when we put them all together and threw them against the Soviet Union when they invaded Afghanistan. And that was Brzezinski's brainchild. He even bragged about it. And he lined up the money with the Saudis. That's where Bin Laden came from. Al-Qaeda was originally a list, a computer list, of all our terrorist jihadis there in Afghanistan that we were arming, equipping, supplying, training. And as I said, Brzezinski bragged about it. And I went through the exact same PhD program at Harvard that produced Brzezinski before me. So I've been following his career for many years, and we've been consistently using these Islamic fundamentalist terrorist jihadis to, you know, accomplish our objectives, at least since that time. And indeed, you will note this this little princeling now from Saudi Arabia who was just touring our country, and everyone was bootlicking him because he had so much money, stated this publicly just recently on the trip here. He said, to get after Afghanistan, the United States under the Carter administration and Brzezinski came to us and asked for us for our help and money and to spread Wahhabism and madrasas with a Wahhabism, which is the most fundamentalist type of Islam you could possibly imagine. I mean, I travel a lot in the Muslim world. There are a lot of, you know, very moderate Muslims over there who don't tolerate or support terrorism at all, but the Wahhabis are the most extreme sect there in Saudi Arabia, and we set all this up with the CIA. Sure. So we've been using these people at least since that time that I'm aware of.
We're talking with Francis Boyle. He's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So if we aided these folks with the help of the Saudis, why did they turn on us, though? Because now we seem to be certainly at odds with them in northern Iraq, in eastern Syria. You know, these are not, I mean, aren't we fighting ISIS and aren't we fighting the jihadis?
Well, that's what we say we do, but if you look at it, Rob, we let the ISIS people sort of slip out. Whenever we're closing in on them, all of a sudden they slip out and they disappear, and they reemerge somewhere else. So, in my opinion, people are free to disagree. I just think this is a pretext to get us back into Iraq, which has now occurred, and to serve as a pretext to get us into Syria. And indeed, a general slipped out that we had at least 4,000 U.S. forces now in Syria, not counting, you know, State Department people and everything else, to give us a toehold in Syria, which we now have, and we are now occupying the oil fields there in Syria. So I think all this is just a pretext to get us back in there, and you know, there it is, and we're now stuck back in Iraq, and we are in Syria.
You can tell them,
you know, President Obama was honest about this. President Trump, where he said, "Well, you know, we're over there for their oil." And that's correct. That's why we're there. Now, all his predecessors denied that, but at least Trump has at least twice admitted this, that, you know, we're over there for their oil in Iraq. Syria is the same, and, you know, we should be taking their oil.
But if these are people that are acting at our behest, they're certainly killing Americans, killing our allies. They don't seem to be controllable. I mean, they don't seem to be...
That's right. We just sort of unleashed them in the general direction we want them to go, and they inflict death and destruction along their way, and then we use that as a pretext to go in there and stop them because of all the death and destruction they have inflicted. But we you know, historically, Rob, you know, if you look at, you know, U.S. foreign policy, as Henry Kissinger said, U.S. foreign policy is not missionary work, and I went through the same PhD program at Harvard that produced Kissinger before me. They even gave me his old office at Harvard's Center for International Affairs. We constantly use people like the Kurds. You know, we use them and then we turn on them, and that's the history. And you know, these people that we used, they're not smart enough to figure that out, that they're being used, or they're, you know, they're brainwashed on, you know, Muslim fundamentalism or something like that.
Confirmation hearings of the new CIA director, Mike Pompeo, are beginning. What's your take on him?
Boy, he's another hardliner. I don't, you know, who they're... in this administration is going to give President Trump, you know, realistic, practical advice to try to resolve disputes peacefully as opposed with military force. Right now, somewhat strangely, it appears to be our Secretary of Defense, so-called Mad Dog Mattis, who's the only element of restraint right now that I can see. And I'm afraid that Bolton and Pompeo are not a very good combination. So, and I'm not exactly sure where General Kelly stands on all these matters, but it doesn't appear that General Kelly can really provide, you know, proper advice to President Trump. And I don't even know if President Trump anymore respects General Kelly. It does appear that he respects General Mattis, Secretary of Defense, because I haven't heard him say anything critical of Secretary Mattis. So I'm very sorry that that's sort of where we are today. I think the situation's getting worse, not better.
Do you have a few more minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I know you probably have classes to teach. Francis Boyle is our guest. He's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Among his books, Destroying Libya and the World Order. So, Francis, Gina sent in this email. She says, "So, who stands to gain if this is bogus? Who's concocting it, and who stands to gain from all this?"
Well, we stand to gain the Syrian oil fields as we see it, and the Iraqi oil fields, as President Trump has admitted, we should take their oil. And the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about, they stand to gain by selling all these weapons at inflated prices. And I regret to report that, officers in the military stand to gain because they get combat experience. So that's I think, the people who gain. I don't think America gains one way or the other from any of this, but there we are. And Rob, please understand, and your listeners understand, I could be wrong here. I'm just trying to give you my good faith analysis of what's going on. It's sort of like reading tea leaves or to try to figure out the Trump administration between you and me. I could figure out Obama. He was behind me at Harvard Law School, so fine. But, you know, President Trump, it's not easy for me to figure out exactly what is going on there. I have to be honest about that.
Here's an email from Bill in Pinellas Park. He says, your guest sounds like a Trump cheerleader and an Obama hater. I don't doubt his expertise, but that's my take. I thought the reason for Afghanistan, if I recall, was the Taliban and not ISIS. Possibly I'm wrong, but that's the way I recall it, writes Bill in Pinellas Park.
Well, no, I didn't vote for Mr. Trump as president, and I didn't vote for Mrs. Clinton either. Indeed, I think if Mrs. Clinton had been elected president, we'd already be at war with Russia right now. I think we dodged a bullet on November 8, 2016. But the same forces that were behind Clinton pushing for war against Russia and in the Middle East are still at it today, pushing President Trump. But I'm not a Trump supporter at all. Indeed, I've already said here, I think it would be an impeachable act for him to go to war against Syria. And indeed, there's something to be said now for someone in the House of Representatives to immediately put in a bill of impeachment right now to send a shot across Trump's bow to try to deter him from attacking, as happened to President Obama. And Obama and I had the, you know, same jurisprudence teacher together, and he called Obama a disaster. I agree with that. So I'm not a Trump cheerleader. I didn't vote for the man. I'm a political independent, and usually I vote for third-party candidates.
Let's take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Simon in Lakeland. Simon, you're on. What's your question for Professor Boyle?
Professor Boyle, I recall in April of 2010, you were on Summer's show for True Talk, and you made the quote, sir, that Ariel Sharon and the Jews control the foreign policy of the United States. That was an article written by Georgie Ann Geyer of the Chicago Tribune that stated unequivocally that she did not use an independent source for that comment, and you refused to retract that comment, sir. The other thing is, was Zygmunt Brzezinski...
Well, sir, I don't... You know, that's hearsay on hearsay. What I said was that Ariel Sharon was a war criminal for sure. But
why would be a war criminal?
Excuse me, sir.
Simon, give him a chance to answer.
Go ahead.
50 minutes, I've said very little about Israel, have I? Hardly anything. This has all been straight out power politics analysis, and I only responded to one question about the role Israel might play here, and I said that Israel is a wild card, that we don't know what they're going to do. But I've spoken for 50 minutes here about the situation, and I said nothing about Israel except that one comment.
There have been many articles where Netanyahu has stated that he would like Assad to stay in power, sir, and that he's even met with Putin to discuss the issue of Assad staying in power. Israel does not want a wild card in Syria. What they're concerned is with Iran, and also in Russian, more so Hezbollah, influences in Iran. In Syria, sir.
All right, Simon, thanks. Well, thanks for your comments.
Well, let me respond to that, too. I was an advisor to the Syrian government at the Middle East peace negotiations that were convened by President Bush Sr. in Washington, D.C. in 1991. And what happened was that Prime Minister Rabin did conclude a comprehensive peace treaty with Syria under Assad the father, calling for full peace, for full withdrawal. Okay. And that peace treaty was ready to be presented to the Knesset. It was toward the end of 1995, but elections were coming up in 1996. And Rabin was murdered by his own people. All right. And that was the end of the Middle East peace process. And indeed, Netanyahu and his ilk at that time were goading people to take action against Rabin. And once Rabin got in there, and indeed even recently Netanyahu said, we are never coming down from the Golan Heights, and Israel has now attempted to carve out, they are legally occupying the Golan Heights, and now they have attempted to carve out a buffer zone, stealing even more of Syria, which they originally stole in 1967. Israel has attacked Syria illegally dozens of times under Netanyahu, and Netanyahu has always wanted to overthrow the Assad family government, the father and the son, because he was against the Rabin peace treaty with Syria. And the Syrians, both father and son, insisted on the Rabin peace treaty, and Netanyahu would not give it to them.
All right, let's take another phone call. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. We're talking about the very tense situation in Syria with Francis Boyle, who's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. Let's go to Henry, who's in Odessa. Henry, you're on. What's your question?
I don't really have a question. I just want to give kudos to your guest for telling it like it is. And I just wonder why so many people, including the management of this very station, fall into the neoliberal trap of anyone dare criticize Obama or Hillary Clinton is a Trump supporter. That's all I got to say. Thanks.
Okay, Henry, thanks a lot. There's
Henry,
a lot of diversity.
Thank you. I'm glad my message came through. I'm not a Trump supporter. I'm not a Clinton supporter. I'm an independent, politically independent, objective analyst. You are free to disagree with me if you want. But given what's at stake here, I'm not trying to push any party line one way or the other, and I didn't vote for President Trump, and I didn't vote for Mrs. Clinton. Indeed, it just seemed to me like a choice between cholera and the plague. But we, you know, at least we have President Trump here. So far, we don't have World War III. But I do believe if Clinton was in there, we'd probably be at war with Russia today.
Amin writes this. I love this guy. That's exactly what's going on, what he says, not to mention the involvement of Israel in funding ISIS and even treating the injured terrorists and sending them back to Syria. That's Amin's point of view. Francis, is there any evidence that Israel is funding ISIS, and where can we find substantiation of that? And do they treat injured terrorists and send them back to Syria?
I do not know if Israel funds ISIS. As I said, I've identified the sources, I believe. However, it is clear, and there are numerous sources in the public record, that Israel does take in wounded. They've carved off this buffer zone in Syria beyond the Golan Heights, and they do take in wounded ISIS fighters. They treat them, and then they let them go back to the battle. That can be confirmed from reputable sources.
If people wanted to read that somewhere, where could they see that?
Well, there's a big Google out there. I have read it. I think okay. You can read it, and probably, in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. I read them both every day for...
Yeah. I wonder if that's a humanitarian act on the part of Israel or...
Pardon me?
I wonder if that's simple humanitarian act on the part of Israel, or...
No, I don't think so. As I said before, Israel, the Assad government insisted on the Rabin peace treaty, and Israel backed off. They've wanted to overthrow Assad ever since then and hold on to the Golan Heights. And so, as they see it, ISIS is a tool that they can use to overthrow the Assad government, which is the objective here, right?
Because ISIS is a sworn enemy of Assad. Okay,
that is correct. They are Sunni Muslim fundamentalist extremists that we have helped funneled in there through Turkey and Jordan and elsewhere. Right.
Now, Adam,
we reprogrammed a lot of these people from Libya. That's what Ambassador Stevens was doing over there in Benghazi when, unfortunately, he got killed by some of our own people. I've been to Benghazi, and not recently, but that's what was going on. We had a pipeline where we were funneling weapons, equipment, supplies, and jihadis from Libya to Turkey and then down into Syria. Yeah, I think even Joe Biden admitted that's what was going on when he was vice president.
You brought up the Sunni religion. To what extent do you think that what's going on in this part of the world, in northern Iraq, in Syria, in eastern Turkey, to what extent is this, and in Yemen, to what extent are we seeing play out a proxy war of Iran versus Saudi Arabia? Do you buy into that theory that this is all Iran versus Saudi Arabia?
No, I'm sorry, I don't, Rob. I, you know, as I see it, we have used 9/11, 2001 as a pretext. Bush did, and all his neocons, to go out and steal as much oil and gas as we can all over the world. And that's exactly what we've done in Afghanistan, Central Asian oil and gas supplies. And by the way, we're going to be building that oil pipeline from Central Asia down to the Indian Ocean, in Iraq, in the Persian Gulf, Syria, Yemen. So we're either stealing as much oil and gas as we can, or we are controlling the strategic choke points for the shipment of oil and gas, like all the right there, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait right off of Yemen, the Straits of Malacca, Syria is a choke point, et cetera. So I don't really buy into that, but religion is being used by all these actors involved to, I guess, mobilize their people. So I don't see this as a clash of religions, clash of civilizations. Indeed, the author of that, Huntington, was ahead of me in my PhD program at Harvard. So I'm fully aware of Huntington. Just to give you a background there, I refused to study with him and many others because of his diehard support for the Vietnam War. Just as a matter of principle, we would have nothing to do with the man. I don't accept that this is, what is really going on here.
Well,
oil and gas, control, domination, and regretfully, Islam is being exploited because, there are many Sunni Muslim moderates out there. I've dealt with them all over the world.
Well, Francis, I wish we had more time. Lots of issues to explore, but thanks for coming on for a whole hour here on WMNF. I think our listeners were in total agreement with you, and some were very skeptical. But if people want to read some of your writings online, how can they find you?
Yeah, if you just Google my name, it'll come up, and all my books should be there. So that's the easiest way. You can pick out whatever one you want. Right? My new book is entitled Poems Against the Empire. It's my latest book. I was appointed a professor here in the Unit for Criticism and Interpretive Theory, Lit Crit. So I decided to write poetry. And you might be interested. It's sort of my poetic reflections on 50 years of doing this type of work.
Well, Francis Boyle, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Thanks for your time.
Well, and thanks for a very fine interview, Rob. And as I said to your listeners, I don't guarantee at all that I have the truth here. I'm just trying to figure out what's going on, and regretfully under President Trump, it's a lot harder to do.
All right, Francis, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks to James Boyles for being our phone producer today. This is WMNF in Tampa. James Lyles was our phone producer today. And if you want to comment about the show, call us up at 813-238-80.